Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Thank you to Patrick McGuire for looking after the place last week. Coming up on today's episode, another brand new exit interview, this time with former Conservative Minister Paul Scully. He tells me why he's standing down and the toll that politics can take on family life. Before that, the columnists Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on just how much hot water is Angela Rayner actually in. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on your Times radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. I had a very Times radio sort of a week off. Spent the Easter weekend painting and decorating with Fowler and Ball. And then a few days in Spain. Yeah, we went and had a look at the old Olympic thingy, Olympic stadium and whatnot. So went up the mountain, went down the beach and whatnot. It was nice. I am now 92% patatas bravas. I've had my tests done. So it's been nice. Anyway, it's nice to be back in the saddle. But now, before getting on with what's coming up, I need to address something that happened just as I went off, just before the Easter break, because for almost 4 years, I've enjoyed a mad, funny, at times tempestuous marriage with my radio wife, who has now left me.
Mariella in your wine cellar.
Warmth, wit and expertise.
I could sit on your special sex chair.
It's not a sex chair, it's a saddle stool.
There are not enough antibacterial wipes in the world before they would get me on that thing.
I'm so relieved to find out that there is a bit of Irish blood in there, because that's where I was brought up. And if I feel anything at all, to be honest, it's pretty Irish.
There's 7% Irish.
I'm more Irish than Mariella.
That is really annoying. No, you definitely don't want a low-fat sausage. Please don't get an erection. Please don't get an erection. I've smelt that penguin love.
We've checked the Ofcom rules. Batshit's fine.
Fine. Batshit. We've spent 3 years agitating and trying to get on
so
pointless.
So I think, as a New Year's resolution, we should try in 2023 to get on to pointless. So there is an issue with pointless, because we did finally get on it. In fact, we recorded it at the end of 2022, and they still haven't aired. So you will get one more dose of Mariella and me arguing on the airwaves at some point. we think towards the end of this season of Pointless Celebrities. For now, I just want to wish Marielle all the luck for the future, all her campaigning. I wanted to get her back on for just one last coffee break to say goodbye, but she's in denial. She is literally, she's in Egypt. She's on, you'll be surprised to know, she's on holiday. I'll see her on Pointless, or at least you'll see us on Pointless. So lots of love to Mariella.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
Yeah, it's that time on a Monday where we hear from Libby Purvis. And Rachel Sylvester's here. Rachel, how are you?
Hi, Matt. I'm very well, thank you.
Very good, very good. Let's start with the story which, despite Labour's sort of crossing its fingers and shutting its eyes and hoping, just hasn't gone away. The question's over Angela Rayner's two houses. Or is it one house? You'll remember that this is, she had a house, her husband had a house, and she later sold her house, which she said was her own residence. It was her main residence, so she didn't have to pay capital gains tax. It was normally if you sell a second home, you do. But was she living in the house which is owned by her husband? The Mail on Sunday had new pictures and posts that she'd put on social media at the time saying it's nice to be home and it was the home of her husband and not her home. So was it actually her primary home? And so has she broken both electoral and tax law when it comes to what she'd registered as her primary address? Well, her colleague, Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy, tried the everyone should just move on tactic when he spoke to Sky News yesterday.
Look, I think there's a different arrangement and expectation for the Prime Minister than there is in this context.
Okay.
We're not yet in government.
Trying to argue that actually it's different if you're the Prime Minister and everyone should just move on and sort of forget all about this. How, I mean, it's always one of those stories, when, I can't remember when this started now, 2-3 weeks ago, Rachel? How problematic is this for Angela Rayner, do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think you can say that different rules apply if you're in government or in opposition when it comes to sort of doing the right thing. So I don't agree with David Lammy about that. But I'm not sure that this story is going to be electorally significant, if you like, because two reasons, really. It's very complicated to understand. I mean, you just took quite a long time to explain it. And also, I'm not sure there's any corruption involved here or you know, deliberate tax avoidance. There's a complicated family situation, and I think a lot of voters are going to understand that, really. It's more about, you know, having a sort of, you know, blended family, different homes, two homes in a way. I don't think in the end it's going to have an enormous impact, but it is an irritant and it isn't going away and it is distracting from other things.
What do you think, Libby? Because I suppose there were two knock-on effects. One is Angela Rayner can't do anything in public and she is one of their best communicators and reaches a particular part of the electorate, so that's problematic. And were it the boot on the other foot, Angela Rayner would be absolutely at the forefront of accusing a Tory MP of doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, it's unusual for me to disagree with Rachel, but I actually think it does have a huge, huge impact. If it is true that both she and her husband each sold their houses as prime residences without paying CGT, then that actually does matter because you don't pay capital gains if it's your prime residence. And that's a good lump of money. And everybody else has to do it. You know, if you move out of your flat, you know, because you've got married and then you rent your flat out for a bit to somebody and then you sell it on, you pay capital gains tax. And I think people are also aware of all this. And I think the whole weirdness of it, even in a blended family situation, feels as if she is somehow taking advantage of that and being unfair. And especially when she profited by right to buy on reselling. And in affluent people, good earners, that always feels uneasy, frankly. You know, I always thought people should have to sell it back to the council, you know, with a very small advantage rather than the huge advantage that houses give. So I think it does matter. I think it registers.
I mean, we should point out this actually all dates back to, 2007 she bought the house. Then she sold it in 2015. She became an MP in the 2015 election. So it's sort of pre her. And she was
a care worker.
Care worker then, in the union as well. But there was part of the problem is so complicated. There were two issues. Did she pay the tax properly? And was she registered to vote at the address? And if it was a primary residence, she should have been registered to vote there and not at the other one. The Tories clearly are making hay with this, but I mean, partly haven't been on the receiving end of quite so much attack from Angela Rayner for all sorts of things, which previously they might have said, oh, no, it's all sort of fine.
Yeah.
In a way, it would have been easier, wouldn't it, if she'd have just come out and said, look, actually looking at it again now, maybe I should have done. I'm going to pay £1,500 because it's, what was it, £1,500 in possible capital gains?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite small amounts in the scheme of things, isn't it? Compared to, for example, the amount that Lord Ashcroft didn't pay in tax, quite legitimately, because of being a non-dom. He was the person who highlighted this story in the biography that he published about Angela Rayner. So there is, you know, in terms of the amounts of money, it's quite small. There is a problem for Angela Rayner because I think the issue is she's this symbol, if you like, of social mobility. Mm. So she came from this extraordinary background. Her mother was bipolar. She had a child at 16 and left school. Very, very poor background. And as Libby says, she benefited from the right to buy, bought her own home. In a way, it's a success story. Sort of, she's a Thatcher girl. She's benefited from that right to buy policy that Margaret Thatcher brought in. But I just don't think it's corruption. And I mean, I may be proven wrong, but I don't think she deliberately avoided this or even necessarily, we don't know exactly what happened, whether she did do something wrong. So it's at least ambiguous. It's a grey area at the moment from what we know currently.
I mean, my reading of it, Libby, is that she thought that if they both, you know, they both own separate homes, they both called them, you know, they both said, well, that's mine, that's yours. When I sell mine, that's it. And you said, without necessarily getting to the fact that as a married couple, you can only have one primary residence. So it's entirely possible, Libby, the explanation is that she did everything with good faith. There wasn't a deliberate attempt, but she may have actually broken the rules.
Yeah, but you see, we all do this. I mean, I deal with HMRC a fair bit, having been one of these people that was forced to have a service company by the BBC, which actually made no real difference to the tax I paid. But the moment you think that you maybe have broken a rule, you know, your accountant or whoever, you know, you sort of says, I don't know, you say, oh, no, I'm so sorry. You know, here's the money. And I think that's what's missing in this case. You know, there's the feeling that I'm Angela Rayner and I don't have to say sorry to anyone about anything. Okay, you know, partly because of this difficult, wonderful background of hers. So I think, you know, I think it just feels wrong. You know, as a sort of potential Labour voter, it makes me uneasy. Though I think in every other way, she's rather splendid.
But she says, of course, she's had legal or accounting advice saying that she didn't need to pay the tax. So I think there is a case that, you know, that she should publish that and say exactly why that advice was given. We don't know exactly what that said.
And all the time, it means that she can't, you know, particularly in the run-up to local elections and so on, you know, one of their most high-profile, well-known people aren't out there. Peter's been in touch saying Angela Rayner's tax advice no doubt enabled her legally to avoid tax. This is a question of hypocrisy, taking advantage of the evil Tory right to buy policy, then selling it at a profit. And then Tim says the Rayner story is just confected nonsense. Daily Mail just maintaining a non-story to smear her in Labour. You shouldn't be giving it oxygen. So I think we've probably covered the full waterfront there in terms of opinion. But I'm pretty sure that if it was a Tory who was in the same boat, it would be absolutely endless from the Labour Party. So, yeah, I suppose that's politics. Let's turn our attention then to a Tory who has been in the news. While I was on my holidays in Barcelona, I was trying to work out what was the Catalan for spearfishing. Libby, you've written your columns today about, I mean, your bafflement. I have to say it's bafflement that I share, that we wouldn't say we were the same in the generation necessarily. The William Wragg story and the honey trapping. One golden rule for life is don't take a photo of your nether regions.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those comically balmy situations, edged with a sort of faint paranoia about how it might be a foreign spy trying to trap him. But, you know, he takes a picture of his, let's say, his hazel grove and sends it to some random stranger and then gives away other, you know, because he feels he may be blackmailed. But what struck me as fascinating was that it's 20 years old, the smartphone, and nobody previously used to take sort of with their box brownie or whatever a picture of their bits and send it on to other potential people who might be interested in them. It's sort of ridiculous. You know, this cyber flashing and the sexting that school kids do. You can understand children are dirty little beasts, really, sometimes, you know, and adolescents, all the rest of it. You can see why it might be a trend there. But this is a 36-year-old man who's a deputy chairman of the 1922 committee doing it. And it's kind of bonkers. And people say, oh, it's just a gay thing. No, it's not. You know, being gay doesn't necessarily make you an idiot. and I found the whole thing just fascinating. I thought somebody needed to boggle, you know, unless my entire column is just a boggle on what the hell is going on.
I mean, I just don't, whether or not, because I just don't understand why anyone would take a photo of their, as you call it, your hazel groves, which is William Wragge's constituency. I don't, what if someone got in touch and said, as appears to be the case here, oh, don't you remember we met once at a party or something? Oh, no, I don't really remember. And before, how did you get from, oh, I don't remember meeting you, to here's a picture of my...
I know. I can't understand it. And you're an MP, so you must know you're a kind
you're
of target.
Yeah.
You're a high-profile figure if, you know, you're open to embarrassment. The thing that I reading Libby's column reminded me was when I was doing the Times Education Commission, hearing from Amanda Spielman, who was then the head of Ofsted, about how many girls at school receive dick pics. And she said it was something like 9 in 10 girls say they've received some kind of unsolicited image that they didn't want. And she described going into one classroom and saying, look, how many of you have had a dick pic? Excuse me if I'm not allowed to say that on the radio.
We've said it twice. I think we all know what you mean. And
a majority of the girls put up their hands. You know, this is terrifying, horrifying, shocking. So it's a much wider thing. And what Amanda Spielman said that I thought was really interesting was, you know, we've got a television culture with programmes like Naked Attraction, and it's a much broader cultural issue than just sexting. Somehow there's been a kind of debasement or vulgarity introduced into the public debate that makes this kind of thing acceptable. But I think it goes back to, in order to tackle it, it goes back to education, and you have to teach children that this stuff isn't a good idea. You know, it's mad and wrong. Mm. And that you have to have that really woven through the education system, that matters.
Yeah. But it's adult. I mean, it's one thing, like the point that you make, Libby, it's one thing children doing stupid things, but a grown adult who's been an MP for nearly a decade.
But what I say at the end, really, is it's got to go either one or two ways. Either this has got to become so acceptable that he'd be no more blackmailable than if he'd been spotted buying cafetières in John Lewis or something. It could go that way, or it could go the other way. I mean, cultures can grow up. I mean, the example I give is that the Georgians used to pass a chamber pot under the table at gentlemen's dinners, you know, so that they could all have a quick leak during dinner. And we don't do that anymore, not even at the Garrick. So maybe cultures can grow up. And maybe one day the very idea of sexting at any age would just be sort of, oh, how ridiculous, you know, don't do that. That's just indecent. You know, so it's got to go one way or the other. Either it's got to become so normal that nobody minds it, or else we've really all got to grow up.
Well, we'll see if society does change in the way that you... I must admit, I didn't know about that, about the chamber pots. That even that is less weird, I think, than taking a photo of your hazel groves, Libby. I want to ask you about graduate trainee schemes, because there's a great... I mean, there's a long read on the Times today about the sort of the death of them, and what used to be a great way to get you in to high-flying companies for a year or two. You'd learn the life of the office and maybe a bit of mentoring and some training, and you'd work out, was this the sort of industry for you? This whole piece, Rachel, is basically just sort of sitting at home in bed on Zooms, having a miserable time. And is the grad scheme dead, the Times asks?
I think it's fascinating. It's partly to do with working from home, that it's very hard to learn what an office is like, what a job's like, learn from your sort of older colleagues if you're not in the office. But I think there's something slightly broader that isn't drawn out explicitly in the piece, but that there's a mismatch between the expectations of graduates and the reality of the workplace, and also a mismatch between what employers need from graduates and the training and education that graduates have been given. So, you know, I think it's 3/4 of employers say that they don't trust purely rely on GCSE and A-level or degree results to choose, but they use their own online assessment systems. And many of them say they have to give extra training in basic skills to new recruits because the education system just isn't preparing children for work. So there's sort of two things. There's a sort of sense of graduates thinking it's immediately going to be, you know, running the company, everything incredibly interesting, a sort of not exactly entitlement, but a sort of overinflated expectations because they've always been told this is going to be fantastic. Yeah. But then also employers not having the skills that they need in those graduates. So the whole thing is slightly breaking down, I think.
And there's this sort of generational gap as well, Libby, of sort of middle managers who quite like working from home because they've got nice big houses and they necessarily want to come in every day and all that sort of thing. But actually being young in your first job, being in the office every day, even though you might think you'd rather be at home, being in the office every day and, you know, learning from your bosses and learning office politics as much as anything else is a really important part of the workplace.
Especially as home might just be a sort of a half a room in some overpriced London flat. I have to say, I read the piece and it sounds awful. If these reports from graduate trainees about extreme overwork or just doing nothing at all, if these reports are accurate, these companies should be absolutely ashamed of themselves. They overpromise. They want to suck in the best and brightest and get anything they can that's best and then get rid of them when they don't want them. They either overwork them or they ignore them. It sounds disgusting. And actually, looking at the names of some of the companies, no more than I would expect. I think graduates should be very, very careful of these sort of shiny graduate trainee schemes. I had a chance to apply for one and I remember thinking, no, actually, I don't want anything to do with that. And I went off into a small technical job at the BBC because I thought I wanted to learn something new and be somewhere and go into offices.
Yeah. Well, but I applied for the Times graduate trainee scheme and didn't get it. It took me about 15 years to finally get here. Loads and loads and loads of people getting in touch about all the stories we've been discussing. Angela Rayner's explanation doesn't pass the smell test, says Chloe. I disagree. I don't think the tax laws are complicated. However, it definitely won't stop me voting Labour at the next election. I've voted Tory in the past. We'll never again for a party that criminalises homelessness. That's Charlie who's been in touch. And Alfie says, why not isolate the data surrounding the Angela Rayner case and put it to correct lawyers to get opinions? No need to see the paperwork. Isn't the issue hypocrisy, says Chris. And on the taking photos of your nether regions, Stephen says, get real, I'm 50. And everyone I know has at some point sent naked pics to someone else. It's pretty normal. And we used to have it as a laugh at the pics we got. And then Neil's been in touch saying, I once took an intimate picture of my naughty bits and accidentally sent it to everyone in my address book. It cost me a fortune in stamps. So thank you for that, Neil. Right, let's rewind the clock a little bit. Let's go all the way back to the exit poll of 2017.
And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage. 314 for the Conservatives, that's down 17. 266 for Labour, that's up 34.
Yeah, Theresa May took that gamble. Didn't quite pay off, did it? The Tories went backwards, but they still won. Just don't tell Jeremy Corbyn supporters he didn't win that election. But a new analysis of YouGov's polling for The Times shows that Keir Starmer is heading for a 154-seat majority with a vote share almost identical to Jeremy Corbyn's in 2017. So how does that work? We're here to tell us, senior data journalist for The Times, Joey Durso. Joey, explain this.
Yeah, I mean, that clip takes me back because I was actually working at the BBC at that point and I was one of the voices in Dimbleby's ear and that was so shocking. You know, no one saw that coming, that terrible result for Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn and Labour doing unexpectedly well. They got a really high portion of the vote, 40%, but nowhere near winning a majority. They actually didn't win that many seats off the Conservatives, I think about 20. Keir Starmer and Labour is on course for a pretty similar share of the vote, 41, but on course for an absolutely thumping majority. The reason for that is he's basically winning voters in all the right places. And interestingly, it looks like Labour are losing voters in about 50, 60 seats. You know, real people who are leaving the Labour Party, going to the Greens and the Lib Dems. We know lots of Labour voters are annoyed about Labour stance over the conflict in Israel and Gaza. Or people who, you know, are left-wing voters who don't like the way the party's gone under Starmer. But these people tend to be concentrated in big cities, in inner London, places like Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, where Labour has huge majorities. So ultimately, they can lose a load of those voters and it doesn't matter. And Labour is gaining voters in the places where it does matter, the suburbs, the towns, you know, places in the West Midlands, in Yorkshire, where they lost, they won repeatedly under Tony Blair, even places like Essex and Kent that traditionally voted for New Labour have abandoned the party and it looks like they're coming back. So basically, yeah, it looks like Labour under Keir Starmer are losing voters that don't matter, gaining ones that really do matter, and the overall vote share is staying pretty constant on 2017.
It's pretty extraordinary this, Rachel, given that this is a guy who sat in the shadow cabinets of Jeremy Corbyn, pushing exactly the same policies, that he ends up getting the same vote share.
Well, it's fascinating, and I thought Joe's piece explaining that Starmer's just being more efficient about the vote distribution is really interesting. But for me also, what it says is that you win if you appeal to people who aren't your core vote. You win if you appeal to the centre. And I think there's a lesson in that for the Conservatives as well. You don't win by rushing to the extremes, rushing to the margins, as Jeremy Corbyn did. You win by trying to appeal to as wide a range of voters as possible, even if that means you sacrifice some of your hardcore, most, ideological traditional supporters.
Because we used to talk, Libby, about the Tories piling up all their votes in rural areas, which didn't do no good at all. It was only then when they got to reach into some of those more suburban areas, even some cities as well, that's how you win elections.
I think there's even a rumour that some rural areas like ours, which is absolutely solid Tory, Suffolk and Therese Coffey and so on, that may wobble. I think there's a very strong feeling towards the centre in Britain at the moment. There's a feeling towards kind of administrative common sense and no bonkers ideologies. So I think that will be a very strong feeling. As I pull, the more you can appeal to the centre, the better for you.
And Joey,
the Conservatives are not managing that at the moment.
We heard reports about Muslim voters leaving the Labour Party. Is that significant, or is that part of the same story?
It's definitely a real thing. I think lots of Labour voters, whether they're Muslim or not, are disaffected about Gaza. And you can see that in the numbers, that in the kind of places where Muslim voters are concentrated in inner cities, Labour is falling back a bit. But brutally, it doesn't make a difference in terms of seats. Mm. And that doesn't mean that those voters are any less important than ones in the suburbs or the towns. But in our electoral system, it doesn't make a difference. And we know that Muslim voters are very concentrated in those cities.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester, of course, you can read them in The Times every week with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next is the exit interview of Paul Scully.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Thing.
We've already said.
Paul Stewart Scully is leaving us soon.
Goodbye.
Born in 1968, he's been the MP for Sutton-in-Cheam since the Tories wiped out the Lib Dems in 2015, one of dozens of MPs quitting at the next election. In his exit interview, he reflects on nearly a decade in Parliament and what he's learned about politicians' shortcomings.
Most of us that want to be MPs have a slightly stunted emotional intelligence by dint of having the ego wanting to get there.
Describes his proudest moment.
Start this statutory inquiry for the Horizon Postmasters, the biggest miscarriage of justice in British court history.
And gives his verdict on his former bosses, including David Cameron.
I think transformational in terms of the party, transformational.
Boris Johnson.
Charismatic. There's plenty of other things you can say, maybe, I don't know, chaotic on these kind of things.
And Rishi Sunak.
Sort of corporate manager.
And he reveals the toll politics can take on family life.
Slightly depressingly, I got divorced halfway through. If there is a chink of difference in your marriage or family life or whatever, politics has a habit of just blowing that open slightly.
So, Paul Scully, thank you for joining me for your exit interview. A chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. First question then, why are you leaving?
Why am I leaving? So things are clearly tricky for the party, but it's not a matter of just running away from things. I was never going to retire as an MP. I didn't want to be shuffling around the Commons in my 80s. I came into it almost by accident, and I sort of like want to leave things whilst I still want more, because I still love the job. I think I'd win my seat if I stood again. It'd be a challenge, but I think I could win it. It's more about the next 5 years, and I'm not going to be here for the long term. Part of the long term solution for the party. Best I step aside, let someone else come in who's hungry for that, let them do that while I go on to my next stage.
You talked about how the Conservative Party had lost its way. What do you mean by that?
I think at the moment, there's so much happened at the moment. A lot of that is the global situation, whether it's Brexit initially and how Parliament as a whole dealt with Brexit, and then COVID, and then the cost of living exacerbated by the Ukraine situation, and of course now with Gaza, all of those factors have come in. But then there have been avoidable mistakes that we've made as a party, which has just made it more difficult to deal with. So actually what you find now is a parliamentary party who seem to be looking for the next thing rather than the fight that's ahead of them, the general election that's ahead of them. So there's no vision at the moment. I think that's what we've got to focus on. What's the vision for the next 5 years rather than just crisis management?
Is it a party that currently deserves to win an election?
That's a really tough question. Until we articulate the vision. Without a vision, you can't really say so. But I mean, that vision has to come through a manifesto. So I'm not saying it doesn't, but there's a lot of work to be done to get to that point.
So let's talk about how you said you got into it by accident. How then did you end up as an MP in 2015?
So look, I voted for the referendum party in 1997. So I was challenged by my then MP, a guy called Nigel Foreman in Carshalton and Wallington, when I was saying we wanted a vote on the Maastricht Treaty. He said, well, if you want that, you've got to vote for the other guy, the referendum party. So we did. Funny enough, you'd be careful of what you ask on the doorstep. And so I blame myself for bringing in Tom Brake, the Lib Dem MP for Carshalton and Wallington, and Tony Blair. And so this is almost my penance. I was that guy that joined the party in 1997, 2 weeks after the election, thinking, here's £25, you need it more than I do. And then just gradually things kicked up from there, delivering a few leaflets. I eventually became the chairman of my local association, a local councillor. And that's when the control freakery really kicked in. I think I was the best person to win my local seat. And I was never going to travel around the country to be an MP. It was my local seat.
It's interesting you wanted a referendum. Given everything's now happened with Brexit and what's happened over the last 8 years since Britain voted to leave, do you think stepping back from Britain's relationship with the EU was the right thing?
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that whatsoever. But I was really careful when I said that my first answer, when I was talking about Parliament lost its heads, because I think, we had millions of people voting to leave the EU. A lot of that was because of the relationship with the EU, but some of it was about disaffection, which you would discuss in a different forum. But actually, I think it was less to do with the decision that was taken on that day. It was the 2 years afterwards when Parliament just effectively lost its head that's actually caused some of the disconnect between us and the EU and in terms of our relationship, because you had the people that were the ultra remainers, shall we say, that actually just pretended they wanted it to go away so they could have a second referendum. You had the ultra leavers who were trying to chase a perfection that doesn't exist, who were trying to hope it goes away, so that they could have some Brexit that didn't exist. Those of us in the middle that voted to leave, like me, those that voted to remain, but actually, wanted to have the will of the people, who just wanted to get something done constructively, really got squeezed out.
So where does the blame lie there? Because it was interesting, the last few weeks after it was announced she was going to stand down as an MP, there was lots of, tributes to Theresa May and her incredible public service and so on. Actually, if you look at those 3 years, she was the Prime Minister, which gives you an enormous influence over the national debate and what happens in Parliament. And actually, nothing happened. And a lot of the problems you're talking about were embedded during that period. Did she bear responsibility for some of that?
Well, I'm not going to blame her, but of course she will take responsibility for that as the Prime Minister, but I think that is unfair because it's a collective loss of head, I think, from Parliament itself. Mm. At that time, over those years, you know, anybody that was prime minister would have struggled to bring those, you know, it's like herding cats kind of thing, bring those sort of people together for the reasons that I've said. Michel Barnier, frankly, he must have just thought all his birthdays had come, because he was just stepping back, his hands behind his head, thinking, you crack on and argue amongst yourselves and come to me when you've got some when you've got something to talk about. So we had the deal. Theresa May's deal, I voted for that three times. And I said to some of the leavers, I said, look, if you can find a better one, if you can negotiate a better one, then great, I will hold have my hands up and say, yeah, good on you for sticking your guns. It's interesting that you see some of the people on the Labour side and the Dems and what have you said, well, oh, we've got a hard Brexit, or we've got a relationship that we didn't want. Well, you could have had a better one. You could have voted for one of those deals, but actually you were sticking out for something that you knew did not exist. And so they've got to take equal blame.
Let's talk about your career then. So you got elected in 2015. You then became Minister for London in 2020. Then you've had lots of jobs all over Whitehall. You were Minister for Tech and the Digital Economy at the Department for Science. You were Junior Minister Department for Culture, Media and Sport. You were at Levelling Up Housing and Communities. You were at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. In those, well, Parliamentary Under Secretary, Ministry of State roles, what's it like being in that, you know, listeners who know the sort of the Chris Mullin diary, someone, he was a junior minister, essentially Minister for Paperclips, how he sort of characterised it, worse than being on the back bench. What was your experience? Did you enjoy all that sort of being moved around in the lower regions of the government machine?
I really enjoyed the 4 years of as minister. You have to look at it in the prism of where I was at the time. I was appointed minister a month before lockdown. So literally COVID was all I knew for 2 years. And I was sitting there on Zoom, a team call after Teams call, and other chat applications are available. And those kind of things. And doing a lot of work, thinking, crikey, this must be what it's like to be a minister. I don't think it was, actually, if you look at normal times. Since then, I've done about 12 bills as primary legislation, as bill minister. That works out to something like 8% of the entire government output. Over those few years, I did more media than a lot of ministers. There was a lot to talk about, clearly, in COVID and afterwards, and more meetings and engagement than most other ministers. So I sort of took a step back thinking, crikey, what's everyone else doing? This is, maybe I need to reevaluate. But of course, when you get past COVID, then you start hitting a little bit more normal times.
One of the things that's come up a lot in these exit interviews is everyone's got a thing, whether it's either a backbench MP or as a minister. The thing that you know, the Paul Scully stamp is on, that happened because you were there, whether it's a change in the law or a shift in government policy. Is there a thing that you will look back on and think, well, if nothing else, in the decade I was an MP, I did that?
It's got to be the post office. I was, whilst I was business minister, there's a lot of things that I can, you know, hopefully think I'm, you know, feel proud about. But I know the best thing I will ever do in politics, I knew it at the time, was start this statutory inquiry for the Horizon Postmasters, the biggest miscarriage of justice in British court history, and start the compensation schemes going and reopening it for Alan Bates and the 555 postmasters that he represented. Now, I know this is clearly still going on. I know that postmasters are still struggling. And I said at the time, and I think why I was able to unlock it is just actually realising that it wasn't a software scandal, it was a human scandal. It's the way people reacted to the failure of the software that really hurt those people and destroyed their lives. And I knew that I could say whatever I wanted in Parliament at the dispatch box or what, or directly to them. It wasn't about words, it was about actions, because these people have no trust in politicians, in civil servants, in lawyers, in judges and things like that. You have to act. That's the only way they're going to be able to see results.
You talked about when you were minister, you were often on the media. And there were some ministers, and you know, people recognise them, the ones who come around, regardless of what is in the news. I suspect most of the time when you're out doing the morning round and you're on the Today programme in Times Radio and Sky News and Good Morning Britain and all of that, you're not being asked about your brief. You're just being asked to be kicked from pillar to post about whatever was on the front pages. Tell me about that. How does that happen? How do you end up being the guy, look, Paul, it's a tough old day out there, the polls are bad, there's scandal or, you know, government problems all across the front page. Can you just go out and eat a you-know-what sandwich again on the telly?
I had to have some imaginative ways of shoehorning what I was actually announcing into some totally different types of conversation.
Occasionally, your plain speaking has got you into trouble, though. Most recently, when you claimed that parts of Tower Hamlets and Birmingham were no-go areas, which you then apologised for and said it was a poor choice of words. Do you wish you just hadn't said it?
Yes, I do, because it actually didn't bear enough relevance to what I was actually arguing about in the first place, which was the fact that Lee Anderson's words were anti-Muslim. And that was what I was there to talk about. The reason I apologised for the choice of words is because no-go areas sort of triggers people. They define it in a particular way that I wasn't defining it in that way. What I was trying to say is that people feel uncomfortable travelling into some areas, and therefore whole communities get written off because of that prejudice. And often that prejudice is fueled by headlines based on a handful of people. Now, it might be, you know, we see it, you know, forget colour of skin or faith. It might be old people walking past a whole load of school kids and they feel intimidated by them. It's that kind of unconscious bias or whatever. So it's better to explore that rather than just saying everything's rosy. Mm.
Okay, let me turn to some classic exit interview questions now then. Summing up your bosses in a word, we'll start with your first boss when you came in 2015, David Cameron. Sum up David Cameron in a word.
I think transformational in terms of the party, transformational.
Do you think that transformation's been undone?
Yes, for the reasons that I said at the beginning. Yeah. The fact that it's not all the Conservative Party shooting itself in the foot. There's been a good amount of that, but there's not all about that. There's been a lot happened, as I say, since that I think, you know, any leader would have struggled to cope with.
Theresa May in a word.
Technocratic. Technocratic. She's a really nice woman. I've done a lot of work with her since, actually. She was Prime Minister on domestic abuse and how employers can work with that. I think she's very process-driven. She's very public service-driven. But I think what you need in any leader, emotional intelligence is so, so important. The problem is with emotional intelligence in politics is that most of us that want to be MPs, never mind Prime Ministers, have a slightly stunted emotional intelligence by dint of having the ego wanting to get there. The rest of it gets beaten out of us by the selection process, the election process, and everything that follows.
That's really interesting and slightly depressing. Boris Johnson in a word.
Charismatic, I suppose. It would be the word. You know, there's plenty of other things you can say. Maybe, I don't know, chaotic and these kind of things. What I saw with Boris is he is a larger-than-life figure. He is a very loyal figure. I've seen him within a week as a naughty schoolboy being interviewed by Beth Rigby on Sky, I think about the Partygate and those kind of things, as if he was outside the headmaster's study. And then literally a few days later when Putin invaded Ukraine, I was in a meeting with him and he was so on it. It was about 6:30 in the morning, asking all the right questions and really very, very divisive. He's a man for the big times.
I think the first time I met you was when Boris came to campaign for you in the 2015 election.
Yeah, I think
and I mean, I'd seen it before, but not quite to that extent. The rock star quality you had in 2015.
Oh, hugely.
You know, it took him 2-3 hours to get from the top of the high street to the bottom of the high street.
He
just
came
stopping
a few
and
times.
Peeping and selfies and all of that.
He came a few times and we had to shrink the area that we were targeting because we knew how mobbed he was going to get. And he used to take a load of my leaflets and hand them out and go, "Scullybump, Scullybump, give me some more Scullybump to hand out." And people wanted to be around him and to have selfies taken with him. And he does have, you know, reach the areas that other people can't do.
Well, there's quite a lot's happened since 2015. Liz Truss, in a word.
How do you get that? We're too fast, too soon, sort of. I don't know how to put that in a single word. In a rush. That's three words. That's still three words.
Rushing.
Rushing. There you go. Because I think with Liz, if you looked at the leadership campaign that summer, when you got to the final two, I'd always looked for a Goldilocks character. I needed someone to put rocket boosters under Rishi, someone to pull Liz back a little bit, because Liz was right when she was talking about Treasury orthodoxy, right about sort of more dynamic modelling that you need to do in Treasury to actually look at how your policies change behaviour, not just puts up a figure, puts down a figure. It's not all just about single levers. But she tried to throw everything kitchen sink into a budget and run before she could walk.
So then, Rishi Sunak in a word.
I sort of corporate manager, I suppose. That's two words. So I'm getting better. But and he's good. He's a good man. He's a good, genuine family man. I think he's got a good heart. I think he's wrapped up in crisis management at the moment. If it be me, and clearly, you know, there's no way I'd ever want to be Prime Minister. If I was in this position that we're in now, over the last year, I'd have said, right, this is the single thing I want to do. It's not the five pledges. We need to do those anyway. But this is something I want to achieve to change society, to change the country. It may be something like adult social care that we've been talking about for God knows how long to sort out, but sort a problem out, because he's a really good problem solver, actually. That's what he does. That's what he did in a corporate life. That's what you can apply to politics, as long as you have that emotion on that you realise that politics is also about emotion. It's about vision.
Really interested in that. Well, some other classic exit interview questions. We talked about the thing you're most proud of and dealing with the sub-postmasters. What's the bit of the job you enjoyed the least?
The psychodrama. Probably is the psychodrama, actually, because you sit there amongst people. I talked about some of the times we are shooting ourselves in the foot. It's when you see colleagues that get on with each other, know each other, that are saying things that can't be unsaid. And you can debate, you can discuss, and the whole point about the Conservative Party, like the Labour Party, they are broad coalitions. Ken Clark said to me when he was holding court when I was a new MP, he's saying, you know what, the reason we don't have many coalitions is that coalitions are formed before the election, not after the election. So you've got these two big broad church groups, but then you had first Brexit, and now you're in a similar sort of position when people are feeling entrenched in their own view, and they can't see the view of their colleagues who they were happily sharing a platform with a few years before. And that's something we've got to get back to. We've got to recover from that. And that's why the next 5 years is going to be really important for the Conservative Party.
One of the things that's come up a lot in these interviews, almost every conversation we've had, people have talked about the impact on, you know, there's the abuse and which seems to be getting worse in the way that people treat their MPs, but also the impact that's had on their families. Well, I mean, you're in one sense lucky because you're a London MP, so you're not away for huge parts of the week. But what impact has being an MP and a minister had on you and your life as a family?
First of all, slightly depressingly, I got divorced halfway through, so massive.
Because of the job?
Partly. If there is a... It doesn't cause it. I think if there is a chink of difference in your marriage or family life or whatever, politics has a habit of just blowing that open slightly. So that didn't help.
Because that night that you could have had a chat, actually, you were a thing, you were voting, you were... You know, it takes you apart a lot.
And you have to be really focused at one thing, that allows you to drift. You know, so I just need to do this engagement. I just need to speak to that person. Maybe I just need to have another drink with that person, you know, because so much of it is about networking and social and relationship building. You know, it's not just because we're having fun and those kind of things. You do have to invest that time, but that comes at a cost if you don't get your balance right. Mm. I didn't get my balance right. And it's interesting you talk about being a London MP, because part of the problem is early doors, that a lot of people said, oh, well, at least you're a London MP, you get back home at night, which is true. But the problem is I got back to the back of my ex-wife's head, because I'd be often back after midnight. And so literally, I will see you in bed, you know, that kind of stuff. So
in a way, almost no worse time than if you'd...
Yeah, because you can compartmentalise your time if you're away. But at this time, you're still expected. The constituents expect a lot of you because, oh, you can get back on a Tuesday night, can't you? Whereas if you're in Yorkshire, no, I can only do Thursday or Sunday, that kind of, or Monday morning, that kind of stuff. But it's interesting because you talked about the abuse now, social media abuse, and that has clearly got worse. And I fear it's going to get worse before it gets better, to be honest. I saw a tiny little bit of it. You talked about the no-go areas where the pile-on that came on there, I was really quite shocked at, actually, because you have a lot of people that were genuinely offended by what I said. You had a lot of people saying, oh, good on you, you've just said what other people are thinking. And you had a chunk of people saying, oh, you're supporting Lee Anderson and all this kind of stuff. And when I apologised, they called me a coward. So, well, I can discount those because that's not what I was saying. But then you get a little bit of confected anger as well that are piling on top of the actual frustration and offence and those kind of things, because they see it as a game. Politics is not a game, because we're playing with people's emotions, people's lives. And my bit was a tiny, tiny bit. You know, I get the Tory scum and those kind of accusations. That's water off a duck's back in many ways. But when you see some of the things that female MPs are getting, that people from an ethnic minority background and heritage are getting. You know, I'm half Burmese, but people don't really consider that because I'm comparatively light-skinned. But we talk about Diane Abbott a lot. The kind of abuse she gets is horrendous.
Yeah. So would you recommend this job to friends, family, someone you cared about?
I think be really careful. Yes, it is an amazing job. You have amazing experiences. You can do amazing things. I came in, as I said, to my local seat. Since then, I've done amazing things on the national stage, not least post office, as I've helped cystic fibrosis sufferers get a life-changing job or can be free on the NHS. I've done some international stuff. Being half Burmese, I was the first MP with Will Quince and Anne Main into the Rohingya refugee camps. I saw people coming back literally with the back of their head smashed in with a machete, which, by the way, changes your perspective on what's going on here. But I've been able to talk that, raise those issues on an international stage and those kind of things. So it's amazing. But don't do it because you're this idealistic guy that wants to, or girl that wants to, just become prime minister tomorrow. If that's your view, do not do the job. One, it's not for you, and certainly it's not for the country, frankly.
last question then, in your exit interview, Paul Scully, standing down as Conservative MP for Sutton, Cheam and Worcester Park, what will you do next?
That I do not know. This is the thing, because I was listening to your interview with Robin Walker, and Robin and I were speaking in the tea room with a load of other MPs, and you ask people the question when the election's going to be. You can actually see whether they say it's going to be a May or June election or an October election. Often, if you scratch the surface, it's whether they've got a job or not. So I was talking about it's confirmation bias. So I've got a few things. I'm probably going to do a few bits and bobs. I've taken on, although it's got to go through the committee, ministerial appointments committee, about chairing an insurance company. But that's a small startup thing. It's not going to pay the bills. So there's other things I'm looking at, similar, probably a portfolio career.
Well, Paul, it's been great to speak to you and to get your reflections on almost a decade, a turbulent decade in politics. Paul Scully, thanks for joining us for Exit.
Pleasure.
Paul Scully there with his Exit interview. We'll have another one at the same time next week. And if you want to catch up on all of the previous ones, just search for Exit Interviews wherever you're listening to this. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.